Hey, welcome to the Ring of Fire podcast. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, we're going to listen to my colleague Emma Vigeland's interview with The Intercept's Michelle Garcia about the Biden administration's treatment of Haitian migrants. And of course, Digby and I will be looking back at this big week in news. You can support this program by going to ROFpodcast.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get extra content. That's right. This week, an interview I did with Ari Berman about a week and a half ago about the Republican Party, particularly in Texas, but in states across the country, their attempt to suppress the votes of people of color. So you can get that and all of our member content by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. Thank you. So, Heather, as I look back on this year so far, we're 10 months into the, almost 10 months actually to the day. We're recording this on October 21st. 10 months to the day, almost, of Joe Biden's administration. You and I were saying in in April, May, the next two or three months, and then I think we extended that 5-6 months, are going to define the Biden administration. Not necessarily from a political standpoint, I don't think we were thinking, but in terms of like an agenda, like in terms of like the way that history is going to look back and say, you know, what did Joe Biden do? And I think this week we're getting a pretty good sense of just how small Joe Biden's achievement will be, if there is any. Now, I want to put aside for a moment federal judges, because I actually think the Biden administration has done a pretty good job in that respect, certainly relative to the Obama administration. And I there's not many people who aren't professionally paid to advocate for federal judges under a Democratic administration who feel more strongly about that issue than I do. I don't get paid for that. But my point being, that's no small stuff. Mm-hmm. But in terms of a legislative agenda, I think this week it's really clear that if anything happens, it's going to be small. I mean, you're talking $500 billion of new spending under the bipartisan bill. And right now it's hard to know, but I wouldn't be surprised if we get down to $1.5 trillion over the course of 10 years. So $150 billion. So you're really talking about $200 billion in infrastructure, including physical and, you know, sort of social, which is, just to put it into perspective, not even a third, closer to a quarter of what we spend annually on the military budget. And, you know, we're starting to get a notion of the things that have been jettisoned: community college, child tax credit could be seriously eviscerated, like down to like below what Republican levels would have been had Mitt Romney been president, let's say. There's more. We don't know exactly just how decimated the Medicare expansion will be, if there is any. They're talking maybe a pilot program for dental. I mean, it's all. And the most obvious causes for this: Republicans have 50 seats. Then Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Not sure which one to place before that. But then there really is like a tremendous amount, I think, of incompetence that particularly Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden and the Biden administration share. I mean, to some extent, maybe Nancy Pelosi. But let's start with Manchin and Sinema first, because that's the big obstacle. But, you know, then we should move on to the professional politicians who have been there for 50 years who supposedly got this and they didn't get it.
Well, that's right. And, you know, look, just to set aside the idea of, you know, Nancy Pelosi. Yes, I think there has been some mistakes that she has made with the timing and the various things that happened. But she did get it passed, and she had a very narrow margin as well.
Right.
she did not have, you know, she doesn't have a big, huge group where she could let the moderates have their say and do all that. So she's been managing that more effectively than Chuck Schumer. Now, Manchin and Sinema, you know, we were always going to have this problem. And hanging over this, and you and I've talked about this a bunch over the course of the last, you know, 8 or 9 months when we've been going through this, the threat of leaving the party has always been there. And it always is there when you have a 50-50 Senate, because it just takes one. They all feel their power, right? Every single senator at some point can say to themselves, I could change this whole game. All I have to do is that. Now, most of them aren't going to think that way. They're not going to do it. They wouldn't dream of doing it. They're not Republicans. But you have these people, and there are fewer of them today. But in a weird way, that's worked against them. It's worked against the party because it's just two. It's not like Joe Lieberman in the past, who, by the way, this week we found out Karl Rove really did help him win in 2000. Yep. Yeah, I mean, he was there basically giving him the strategy, but that's beside the point. But nonetheless, there have always been some who did this thing. But in this case, it's just so incredibly, their power is so magnified by the fact that, we're in this highly polarized era. Now, having said all that, and that I'm giving the Democrats some credit here, it is not easy to manage that. It's not easy to manage it when you've got, 60 votes in the Senate, which is what happened when Obama was trying to pass Obamacare. He had 60 votes through most of that negotiation, could beat the filibuster. And it still was pulling teeth because of these, these sort of centrist and conservative Democrats. But having said that, they knew that was what they were dealing with going in here. This was, if they did not think, if they didn't have a plan to get past Joe Manchin alone. I mean, maybe Sinema, they thought, didn't realize was going to be the shape-shifting that she is.
Absolutely. But let me just say this in terms of, like, Manchin, when you talk about the party switching, and you and I saw Jim Jeffords do this back in the aughts, and Arlen Specter do this. And we saw the implications of that. And we should say, prefaced it with the judges. That's the cost. Like people are, well, if we're not going to get the legislation, who cares? It's the judges. Yeah. Breyer is not going to last forever as much as he sort of is under this delusion that he is. And we can get to that in a moment. But so, and it was reported by David Corn this week that Manchin said that he had a two-step plan to leave the party. First, shot across the bow, resign from the Democratic leadership. And if in that instance they don't completely capitulate to all his desires and wishes, then he exits the party. And then he came out, of course, and said, I never said that, which leads me to believe that this is Joe Manchin leaking that he's going to do this as a way of, like, this is the threat, guys. This is how it's going to go down. And so that when I do quit the leadership of the Democratic Party, as opposed to the party, then you'll know I'm serious at that point. Because first of all, why does he need to be in the leadership? He's the freaking president at this point. And so he doesn't need to be there. So I just want to put that into context. And I think you're right. Kristen Sinema completely, who knows? But continue on what you were saying about Chuck Schumer, because I think Schumer and the Biden administration, and I take your point with Pelosi, at the end of the day, she got the ball where it needed to go. And, but Schumer and Biden really, really, like, failure of imagination and plus, but go.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And it is a failure of imagination, and it's a failure. I'm not seeing the plan, I thought in the beginning that what they were doing, of course, they came out $6 trillion. We're going to do this spend. And nobody expected it was going to be $6 trillion.
And to be clear, that was Bernie. That was Bernie. $6 trillion.
Exactly. And Bernie comes out and says, I want $6 trillion. OK, so there's the far left, side of the argument. And then you have Manchin come in and say, no, we're not spending. We're not going to go anywhere near that. And he was even at the time kind of going, well, $4 trillion, that's my max, right? He was coming out and saying, making these big numbers. But my thought was, is that they had gamed this out to some extent and had some idea. You had Joe Biden, the master of the Senate. You had Schumer. You had all these people who've been around forever in there. You're thinking, you know, and Manchin and Sinema's pretty new, but Manchin's been there for a while. And, you know, these are known quantities. And I would have thought, and I did think, I just assumed that these people kind of had a handle on where this negotiation was going to go. And they understood that they were going to have to, and you know, and they were going to move it as quickly as possible. The reason being that the more you do this, the more you go through this sausage making, and it's all out there and everybody's arguing and following Kyrsten Sinema around and Manchin's on his houseboat and go over and over and over again, it plays into the notion of this Democrats in disarray, that they don't know what they're doing. And you can see it in Biden's poll numbers, which are cratering. Yeah. They are cratering. And this is why. The Afghanistan thing, I know he took a hit on that, but I don't think that the American people were really, I mean, that was a moment in time in which everybody was kind of, oh my God, you know, we lost that and we're leaving. And there was this sense of, you know, oh, this is terrible. And it's gone now, right? I mean, nobody's talking about it over. Afghanistan is not an issue that the American people care about. But what they do care about is this thing that's happening and Washington being completely just, you know, it's chaotic in a way, in a different way than Donald Trump was chaotic, which they also hated. But this doesn't really look a lot better. And that was a mistake. They, you know, the idea that they were doing this ongoing Sturm und Drang over how much money and then what does Kyrsten think and what are we going to do? And Biden running around and telling stories about his childhood and Scranton to illustrate what he wants to do, et cetera, et cetera. It just, there's
too
no
much drama. Too much drama.
Yes.
No end game.
Nobody wanted any more drama. That's what they thought they were getting rid of when they got rid of Donald Trump.
And here's the thing. This is the, you know, and so, you know, and I know there's probably some people who suggest that maybe we're being too harsh about this, but people need to remember the sequencing here. After they passed the COVID relief bill, there was a sense that there was like that the opposition had been completely steamrolled. Right. Like, I mean, do you remember, like, I remember us talking about like the Republicans right now. I can't remember what they were talking about, but it was like
Dr. Seuss. They were talking about Dr. Seuss. And
exactly.
Mr. Potato Head.
And so that is the proverbial hot iron when you strike. And instead, I'm looking at this now in February. Well, in June, Biden invites GOP senators as infrastructure deadline looms.
Right.
That was the first original sin.
Yes.
This idea that when the Democrats had the upper hand, when the Republicans were talking, they're passing $1.5 trillion worth of COVID relief, starting the child tax credit, extending unemployment benefits. I mean, on and on. Cutting child poverty in half. And the Republican Party is sitting there talking about Dr. Seuss. And Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema have no idea which way the winds are blowing at all here. No, that's the point, right? Like,
right.
When you extend this out, you are giving your opponents an opportunity to get a lay of the land, to amass their, you know, we can go back and look, when did Joe Manchin go and talk to No Labels and say, hey, man, get, you know, you're going to hire some of these retiring Republican senators, beef up their salary. Like, you don't give them an opportunity to amass their forces. I mean, we could go through a million different, analogies. You're in the 2-minute drill, you're playing football, you get up to the line, you don't wait for the defense to assemble. You got your plan, just go. And instead, Biden gets caught in this mentality that I've got to invite the Republicans there. And then that's not enough when that fails.
Right.
I've got to allow Kyrsten Sinema to, you know, team up with Rob Portman to do this bipartisan deal. And that's where the Biden administration completely blew it.
Yeah.
They blew it. And I think that's at the time, you know, we were saying like, this feels wrong, but they know what they're doing. And they keep saying, we learned the lesson of the Obama years. And And then we find out in July, Joe Manchin had told Chuck Schumer, not just told Chuck Schumer, they signed some type of letter of understanding.
Yeah, it was.
That Joe Manchin's only going to allow for $1.5 trillion to be spent. And Chuck Schumer, the concierge of the Senate, apparently, doesn't think it's important to tell Nancy Pelosi this. Maybe he told the White House. He didn't tell anybody else. You know, Bernie Sanders writes an op-ed in the West Virginia paper last week, slamming Manchin. Well, Manchin's already like got his momentum at this point.
Oh, yeah.
If Bernie Sanders does that in July, maybe things go in a different way. But he doesn't know, because Chuck Schumer, the most valued possession in the world, apparently, is Joe Manchin to like Chuck Schumer. And so they don't do anything. I mean, this is I mean, this is just simply incompetence. I mean, I don't care. Like, I mean, like, you know, like. This is
we said this, Sam. We said this at the time. We talked about the first 100 days. I remember we had a show and we talked about the first 100 days. And you and I both agreed that the first 100 days were, you know, basically that Biden was getting a pretty good honeymoon. And they had the COVID relief thing. The vaccines were coming out. Things were going well. But we said then it's the second 100 days where you start to see, because, and for the very reason that you were just talking about, the Republicans were completely discombobulated from January 6th, from the 4 years of Trump, from not knowing which way the wind was blowing as far as the where the party was going, who was going to be the leader. They felt like they had lost. They'd lost everything. And they were on their heels. And of course, they were going to get it together. I mean, they were going to stop talking about Dr. Seuss at some point and start recognizing where the fault lines were and start to do it. Believe me, Mitch McConnell's probably been on the phone with Joe Manchin more often than Joe Manchin's been on the phone with Joe Biden.
Yep.
This is that they know what I mean. Yes, you can say a lot about Republicans, and I do not think that Mitch McConnell is the genius that a lot of people attribute him to be, but he is an excellent, maybe the best ever opposition leader in American politics. You cannot, that guy can obstruct in ways, and he's completely shameless about it. And the idea that he was just going to sit back and just let this whole, let them work it out amongst themselves was ridiculous. You're exactly right. They had to strike when the iron was hot. And I really think it goes the minute they separated the two bills and let Manchin and Sinema run with it. They empowered them. Did they not know how powerful
totally.
That would
of
make them?
Of course. Of
I
course.
Mean,
and, my God. And then they also knew, I mean, this is the only the fault that I have with Pelosi, is that she sort of like indulged this Gottheimer
stuff. Yeah,
and I mean, look, let's be clear. The salt tax relief is a complete sop to rich people, period. Oh. End of story. There's no like this, you know, it is 80 some odd percent of the benefits of the state and local tax deduction go to rich, really rich people. And but to sort of hold the line with Gottheimer on that, when you're facing something much larger, you know, like it just there, it what's clear is that there was no awareness by any of the Democratic leadership of what was going on in their party. No awareness still of what's going on in terms of just like the politics writ large. Like, I mean, you know, I have people call in on the Majority Report or IM and they say, listeners, and they say like, this has to have been the plan of the Biden administration to use Manchin and Sinema to kill this agenda. And I have worked, Air America was one of those places where I worked, where like people would write in and go like, there must be some type of like mole in there purposely sabotaging this, because there were some people who were just so almost incomprehensibly incompetent. Mm-hmm. That you could only assume that it was a rational assumption from the outside that somebody's doing this on purpose.
Like, right. How could this be?
Yeah, how could someone be this incompetent, be in that position and be that incompetent? Like you're, you know, like how could someone who's like, you know, selling shoes not be able to tie their shoes type of situation? But that really honestly is what we have seen in this instance is that, and it really comes down to Mitch McConnell, because there's no way Joe Biden goes out there and says at the beginning of this, like, I want a $5 trillion bill, and then goes down to $3.5 trillion, and then secretly gets Manchin and Sinema to sabotage that.
$9 trillion,
that's absurd. Like, because Joe Biden could have come out and said $1.9 trillion, and there would have been some pressure for him to go a little higher, but then everybody would have been fine, you know, because nobody expected Joe Biden to do anything of like any type of like consequence. But this is worse. To have attempted and failed this badly, you can look at Joe Biden's numbers. Because
That's the proof is in the pudding there. The numbers show everything. And, you know, there is one thing, though, I want to say before we end this particular conversation. I think the progressives have shown a tremendous amount of maturity, savvy, you know, and ability to work to try to get things done. I have huge respect for the progressives in the Senate, you know, led by Bernie Sanders, and in the House, led by Pramila Jayapal. I have never seen that happen before. It shows a huge amount of an evolution in approach. And it kind of plays into, and I'm kind of excited about that, because even though this thing may end up being horrible and God only knows what happens with the Republicans and Donald Trump, et cetera, we'll talk about that for many, many years to come, I'm sure.
In a moment.
But assuming that maybe there will, you know, that Democrats will be able to somehow, you know, maintain power in some way. I think the progressives have shown themselves to be where the future is for the Democratic Party, and the maturity and the ability and the competence. They've handled this very, very well. And in fact, what you're seeing now, with tremendous disappointment at what they were doing, they are hanging in there and trying to get what they can and working this through. And I feel, you know, I feel a sense of pride, actually, after all the years of watching this happen. So, I just wanted to put that out there, because the Democrats, you can say the Democrats, but I think within the Democratic Party, yeah, there are people that we have to give some kudos to for doing the best they can in this situation. And I also want to point out that when it comes to Kyrsten Sinema, she's a perfect example here of how that sort of the thinking of the past sort of has led her in the wrong way. She started off as a Green and was very, very obstreperous and obstructionist. She went into politics in Arizona. She was someone who was very confrontational. And she decided herself, she said, I want to get something done. Allegedly, this is how she said it. She said, I want to get something done. So she's becoming more and more centrist, and I can work with those people, and then working with Republicans, to the point where now she's a functional Republican within the Democratic Party. But what you find is it's the attitude. Here she is. She is being a total obstructionist on this agenda. She is in that same mindset that she was in the beginning. She has never really changed. She is that person who it's all about her. It's all about her, you know, personal positioning. It makes no sense, because this is, you know, I don't know, you know, her role in all of this is apparently to serve K Street and serve lobbyists, big banks, and pharmaceutical companies, as far as I can tell, which I don't know who in the country looks at. Now, gee, I really want somebody who's, you know, in the pocket of big money, while at the same time kind of wears quirky clothes and wears purple wigs, and she's kind of a different kind of gal. I mean, there is no constituency for that particular mixture. You know, Joe Manchin is much more understandable, Mr. Old-fashioned white, you know, working class kind of.
Well, he's also coming from a state where, you know, Joe Biden lost like 65 to 35, you know, to Trump. Kyrsten Sinema, I don't know if there is a rational explanation. Joe Manchin is just, you know, sort of like very transactional. He's making a lot of money. He's got this, he's going to make this cash. Kyrsten Sinema is, you know, fundraising from these people, but I don't think her fundraising is going to help her from an electoral standpoint. And she's not going to get a job as a lobbyist, because I would imagine every single person in her caucus now is extremely angry with her. Maybe she just gets some type of like sinecure from, you know, some company saying, you know, big pharma saying, hey, we'll get a $2 million a year job for you until you retire because you saved us billions upon billions of dollars by not allowing Medicare to negotiate. I just want to circle back to the progressive thing that you said. You know, this past, I guess it was last week, we had Ilhan Omar on the Majority Report, and I was in talking to her. I knew this, but it was not forefronted in my mind. She was in the leadership of the Democratic state legislature in Minnesota, and it really occurred to me that she is, you know, she is a lightning rod for controversy because she is a woman of color, a Muslim, and someone who speaks out about what I believe is the incredible injustice in Israel and the apartheid regime there. And so she is sort of in many respects painted in the media as some type of like loose cannon type of thing. She is extremely, extremely methodical, careful, plotting. It occurred to me in terms of a legislature, she understands what it takes to get laws made. And she does this without compromise. Without compromising her ideological sort of foundations, but understands how power works. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's the whip of the Progressive Caucus. And she really, I mean, I was really, really struck by that and really struck by how I think I'm getting a clear sense of how the squad is working. Mm-hmm. They understand the star power that AOC has. But AOC does not have the experience as a lawmaker that Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar have. And I really think they're working in concert with each other. They understand their limitations and their strength. And I think it's very encouraging. But with all that said, and I agree with you, it's encouraging. I think it's really hard to project out 2 years, 1 year,
absolutely,
3 years, 7 years, 10 years, take your pick and be hopeful. I am not of the mind that Joe Biden's political fortunes or the Democratic political fortunes rested on the passage of a $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill. I wish it were that way. Mm-hmm. I think delivering benefits to people definitely helps and is a necessary but insufficient political recipe. But the failure to execute their plan or to have a plan,
whatever it was,
gets communicated to the average American voter who doesn't even understand the connection between the government deciding that Medicare is going to cover dental and the fact that they're 65 and they get dental coverage. What gets communicated to them is that the Democrats are getting, like, you know, essentially pushed around and are incompetent and can't win a fight. And I think that has really, in addition to destroying the morale of the base, which I think is highly problematic. You need to start with that. You need to, you know, like, you know, I used to talk about Risk, that game Risk. You need to secure Kamchatka or Kamacha or whatever it is before you move on to the rest of Asia. Like, you need to have your base secured.
Right.
And this would have secured the base. And then they move on to the other stuff. Like, I'm really concerned, and you couple this with what we're seeing in terms of the Republicans willing to do whatever it takes when it comes to gerrymandering, and the Democrats hemming and hawing,
The Department of Justice, which is just this week, you know, Merrick Garland, is he going to, you know, cite Steve Bannon for contempt? Well, gee, we don't know, you know, it'd really be an upsetting precedent and blah, blah, blah. And you're going, are you kidding? You know, I mean, this is.
Why did you put Merrick Garland there in the first?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, I mean, here we, well, to restore the norms, you know, to restore the Department of Justice. And it's like, you know, in fact, I read an interesting tweet, you know, thread by Tom Nichols. I actually put it up on my blog. He's a right winger. I mean, a real right winger, kind of a, you know, warmongering, you know, wingnut. But he, of course, that, you know, he's not an idiot and he has changed his mind. And he's one of those people who has come around and recognizes, you know, what's going on with Trump and what the Republicans are capable of. And what he said was, look, you know, you don't. The time for, you know, this isn't about restoring norms anymore. We're long past. The norms are gone and yeah. They're not restorable in the way that these people think it is. This is a fight. It's a fight. And it is a fight that the Democrats, in what I'm seeing, and I hope I'm wrong here, I'm not seeing a real, you know, energy put toward fighting it. So what we're going to have, I mean, honestly, Sam, what we have to hope for is that Donald Trump just makes an ass of himself. To the point where people go, oh, God, no, we don't want him to keep old Joe or whoever runs in his place. And hopefully, but, I mean, that's all we have going for.
I tend to agree with you. But and we've talked about how the January 6th investigation would be the sort of like the platform for that. But if they don't compel people to testify,
it's nothing then it
completely falls apart.
Yeah, it's nothing.
Well, listen, we will reconvene.
Okay.
We may take a week off next week. I'm not sure, but if we, we will reconvene certainly, if not next week, the week after, and then the week after, and the week after, and hopefully, I'm thinking maybe February or March. We can start talking something about positive. Maybe it'll be COVID has receded. I mean, maybe I don't know. Maybe they'll find that ivermectin is some type of miracle cure. And, be that as it may, Heather, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about it every week.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam, as always.
Many of us saw the horrifying images of U.S. Border Patrol officers riding horses, brandishing their reins as whips as Haitian migrants attempted to seek asylum in the United States. And the Biden administration is attempting to hide from the criticism a bit, in part by portraying Border Patrol and Customs as overwhelmed by the influx and that they couldn't adequately respond. But new reporting shows that they knew this was coming for months. Here to talk about this is Michelle Garcia, a journalist based on the U.S.-Mexico border covering these topics, whose piece for The Intercept is entitled Security Theater, U.S. Border Authorities Failed to Prepare for Influx of Haitian Migrants Despite Weeks of Warnings. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, so let's just start from the beginning, I guess. What happened?
So what happened was the national attention was seized by images of over 10,000, some 15,000 Haitian people under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas, in mid-September. But this issue did not start at that moment. And in that moment, people were saying Del Rio had been nowhere on the map in terms of border crossings, and no one knew, and this had been a quiet outpost along the border. But in July, there had been Central Americans had come over the river, and seeking asylum, and several hundred had been placed under the bridge, right? So when that happens, what officials say is, that's necessary as a temporary staging ground because we're, quote unquote, overwhelmed. We don't have the infrastructure. Well, that's back in July. And going back further, there had been people arriving in numbers in February, according to the Del Rio mayor, Bruno Lozano. So when we have September roll around, and we knew that people, Haitians in particular, had been on their way to the border for weeks. There had been images of a brutal assault against a Haitian migrant by Mexican officials in Mexico weeks prior. This shouldn't have come as a surprise. And when I arrived in Del Rio, I spoke with the county judge, who's the top administrator. I spoke with the mayor. And they also said that they had been told, in the county judge's words, 45 days earlier, knew that people were going to be arriving in large numbers. And the mayor telling me that he had met with Border Patrol to say, what are you going to do in terms of infrastructure? So this sort of surprise arrival is really needs to be scrutinized.
Right. I think the scrutiny is well warranted, given I think the shady way that the Biden administration responded as well, and given the fact that the political situation in Haiti, if you were paying attention to that at all, in addition to the dual natural disasters that Haitians were facing at the time, of course there were going to be mass numbers of people trying to seek asylum in the United States, particularly because the United States has been involved in the Haitian government in a way that is a bit intrusive. And many people could draw a connection and say that the United States was instrumental in a lot of the political upheaval during this time period.
So with regard to the people who are arriving in Del Rio, by and large, did not come directly from Haiti. They're coming from Chile. They're coming from Brazil. Gotcha. They had fled years earlier following, in many cases, the earthquake in 2010 in Haiti, which is not to say that U.S. intervention in Haiti has not been influential, to say the least. These people had already fled Haiti and had sought refuge in Chile and Brazil, where their labor was needed. And so they're coming across, I mean, different people were naming off all of the countries they had passed, traveled through in order to arrive in Texas. And it's like 10 countries. And I also think that it's really worth sort of unpacking and thinking about when we talk about the Biden administration, because I personally have a lot of questions as a journalist on this issue about what we mean by the Biden administration. Having not seen this through or not responded properly. What we're seeing here is the people are put under the bridge, and this is not just in Del Rio. During the Trump administration, people were placed under the bridge in the middle of the summer in El Paso. All summer long in the Rio Grande Valley, people have been under bridges, under the Ansel Duas Bridge. And then what occurs is Republicans use that imagery and also police law enforcement use that imagery, take photos and videos of themselves as a way to sort of hammer at the Biden administration, to blame the Biden administration for the arrival of these people. And that is, in many cases, really problematic. Number one, because they're creating a causality, which is that the Biden administration has adopted certain policies, so goes the argument, and therefore the crisis is, look at all of these people arriving, right? But the problem, and we saw this really culminate with Del Rio, which is people have the right to seek asylum. And the question is, why are there people under the bridge? Why is the misery and the disarray and the out of control, the lack of processing, lack of infrastructure, allowed to be used for political purposes? I mean, I think we need to take a step back and ask ourselves, the sight of children, of women, of families huddled under a bridge is political theater now. And instead of scrutinizing, why was that the case? Why wasn't there infrastructure? And why is this used for political purposes? So much of the attention is, why are they here? How did they get here? And I'm not saying those are not important questions, but we have an asylum process in this country. We have laws. And as journalists, it is our responsibility to ask, where were authorities and in this run-up? And why is this, why is the misery and suffering of people being allowed to be used as political theater?
Well, I mean, you mentioned the Republicans there. Of course, Republicans are going to be draconian and cruel on immigration. That's not a surprise. What frustrates me from the outside is the Biden administration's desire or willingness to give that credence. Because no matter what he does, we see what he's doing with Title 42, which is a Trump-era policy that he's extended and is using the pandemic in order to kind of put a plug on these legal asylum processes. It doesn't matter if he continues a Trump-era policy. They're still going to use that imagery and say, look at Biden being soft on immigration. So you might as well do a structural overhaul of these draconian measures, like you mentioned.
There is definitely a reckoning needing to happen, because for decades, and we can trace this back to at least the Clinton administration that ushered in massive reforms of immigration policy in 1996. Democrats and Republicans have been largely on the same page and have largely been in agreement of a deterrence approach. And we have seen repeatedly deterrence means you are going to create a system, a policy that is so miserable, so in legally questionable, right, that is, you're going to use any weapon in your arsenal to keep people from arriving and asserting their rights under national and international law. And the reckoning is going to occur, which is, do you want a U.S.-Mexico border to continue to be a theater for politics and to be the people who arrive there to be unwitting co-stars in our national political drama? Or are you going to assert a position, a platform, an ideology that puts forward a process infrastructure and says, we're going to uphold the law and we're not going to turn this into a spectacle of violence?
Right. And something you wrote that I thought was so well said was how the system, and you touched on this just now, but the construction of systems are put in place in order to prioritize the spectacle of force. You kind of said it right there. But that is so much of this, right? It's the appearance of looking tough on immigration. At what cost? And we're seeing the cost.
I think that I've been covering border issues for quite some time, and I am a native of South Texas, and I'm in South Texas right now on the border. And one of the things that I think is maybe misunderstood, and I think Del Rio really showed it in our face as Americans, is that when we talk about this, it's considered to be or relegated as an immigration issue. This is how we're going to handle immigrants or asylum seekers. And in the piece that I wrote for The Intercept, what we set out to do is to show an U.S. city, U.S. small city, became occupied territory. There were 700 state troopers in a county of less than 50,000 people. There were thousands of agents, Coast Guard, you had air support. You had a massive mobilization of law enforcement and military, National Guard. And so what we need to be asking ourselves is this going to be the template? Is this setting the stage for a reoccurring, quote unquote, border disaster, where a situation is allowed to spiral out of control, and that the only way to address it is with this massive deployment of military and law enforcement. Are we going to see border cities now become this sort of battleground where you have a state trooper on every corner, every half mile, and this is a literally policed area, saturated?
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to dive a little bit further into some of the stories of the people that you met and spoke with for your piece for The Intercept, because I think they're particularly powerful. We'll be right back. So I think you did a great job talking a little bit about the macro problems of the way that our immigration system is structured, but your piece, which is really great in The Intercept and everyone should read, included a variety of different personal stories of people you spoke to at the border. And I want to dive into that a little bit. I guess we can start with Jean or Jean. I'm not sure how he pronounces it.
Jean.
I should have guessed that given the fact that he's from Haiti. The fact that he said that he felt humiliated, or it felt like a humiliation to be turned away after coming all this way, it broke my heart. Just talk a little bit about his experience and how it was speaking with him.
So Jean became the person, and in any group, you can imagine there's going to be that person who is plugged into what's going on and sort of knows everybody. Jean quickly became that. Everybody knew who he was. He's still sending me videos and posts from the shelter where he's now at. And I think my approach when I interview people in this situation is I approach them as experts in their own situation, experts in what's going on. And Jean definitely fit that. And so what he's explaining to me is they were told that they could stay at a park in Ciudad Acuña on the Mexican side of the river. And then we're suddenly told, no, they had to leave and go to the shelter. And of course, people were really concerned because they had left Del Rio fleeing the fear of deportation, because the Biden administration had initiated all kinds of deportation flights. And he's explaining that they go through this arduous journey, they arrive and do not have the possibility of speaking with an asylum officer. They are under this bridge, and then deportation is used as a sort of threat, and now they have to flee. And this is a person who had left Haiti, gone to the Dominican Republic, studied Spanish, in the process learned English, went to Chile, worked in tourism, and became something of a bodybuilder, and, you know, had a life going on, and for numerous reasons needed to leave. And so I also take the approach that we're not asylum officers. I have seen this happen so many times where we speak with somebody for a short period of time, think we know their quote unquote story, and therefore we put it out there so that people can judge whether they have the merits to stay. The truth of the matter is that when people are fleeing difficult circumstances, they're often very reticent to discuss those circumstances with anybody but an asylum officer or an attorney. And so in this case, and with other people I spoke with, I wanted to know what had happened, where they had gone, what were the decisions, what were the promises that were made. For example, Mexican government telling them they could stay in the park, and then being told, no, you need to board these buses. And they're fearful that they're going to be sent to the southern border, as many other people had been, and just dropped there. And I think that in these moments, it's really important to remember, these are people's lives, bodies. Whatever you may feel about immigration or the border, just think about if a hurricane comes through, or a flood or a fire, and how your life is displaced. I mean, think about losing your wallet and the upheaval. And people are being shuffled about to appease or as a sort of triage. And in the case of Mexico, they were being evicted from the park because they had been told by the Americans the bridge would not reopen until the Haitians were gone from under the park. So their literal bodies were preventing commerce from resuming. And so they had to be moved in order for commerce to resume.
Well, it always kind of comes back to that, right? Do not get in the way of the economic flow of things, and largely you're going to be okay. And that's, I mean, not to make turn it back to another macro point, but that's part of why, in my opinion, Republicans in particular demonize immigrants is because they don't want to fully stop all undocumented immigration because they still want there to be a class of people that do the work that they don't necessarily want to do, but they want to make sure that they're scapegoated and also have like the threat of deportation as something to hang over those kinds of workers. It's all about control, largely, in the context of a broader economic system. Not sure if you want to weigh in on that, but
I wrote a piece a couple of years ago for The Baffler called Border Theater, and talking about how what these sorts of spectacles also allow is that they create conditions in which people, Americans, get to relive this sense of heroism, right? You get to get in there and be cowboy.
I was about to say, it's the cowboy myth. Yeah,
it is. You get to go in there, have this redemptive sort of visual and narrative of putting things under control. And therefore, you assert a moral authority. You have the moral high ground. And again, we go back to the problem with this is we're talking about real people. This is not a Western. And second, they are following the law. The sort of what we're seeing increasingly happen is if you don't allow people to come over the bridge through the traditional route of asking for asylum, then they're going to go through the river. And that creates a certain spectacle, right? And so over and over again, we saw this happen under the Trump administration. We're seeing this happen under the Biden administration, where the conditions are created behind the scenes so that people are funneled through certain places, creating a spectacle so that then order is restored. But it's contrived. The entire thing's contrived.
Yeah. It's amazing how many of our like national outrages as told by certain people are just contrived nonsense that could just be solved with, say, an overhaul of the system. Another story that stuck out to me in your piece was the story about the woman who was pregnant, Gabby, I believe is her name. Tell a little bit about her story.
So Gabby also had traveled through multiple countries while pregnant. She was 6 months pregnant when I met her. And she had said that she felt deceived because she had been told that that people who are pregnant would be allowed, would not be, quote unquote, expelled under Title 42, right? And so what she's highlighting there is you are not abiding by your own set policies. And what gets complicated here, and this is where I think the sort of fight occurs, is people will say, well, this is the Biden administration opening the border for people to come. Well, the issue is that exemptions were created for children, for people who are pregnant, to this Title 42. And what is happening is this, in this chaos, all kinds of information is getting misunderstood or spun, whatnot. It's being shared across multiple countries. And again, we go back to, and as you said earlier, it proves the need for what you see in this is disorder from a lack of a comprehensive, orderly asylum system that does not play to heightened emotions and cowboy drama.
Right. It's a little hard to remove that hero myth that's so ingrained in a lot of Americans. But, you know, I think we're trying our best to do that here.
And I think too, it's also worth thinking about the chain reaction of violence and repression that occurred in Acuña, which we saw the images of the Border Patrol agents on horseback. We saw that. We saw the people under the bridge. What was not seen as widely as the other images were nightly raids across Acuña, where people were ripped from their hotel rooms and apartments off the streets. This really was reminiscent, as I wrote, of the Calderon era, quote unquote, drug war, where people were, by the military, Mexican military, picked up from the streets. And so nightly, there were raids going on, picking up Haitians. And these people were ultimately sent to the southern border, Tapachula, and so forth. And then I think what was really interesting, too, is the people who had been in the park that were then moved to a shelter. I met Mexican women who had cooked these massive dishes. And when I asked them, why are you here to help? One of them said to me, it was two sisters, and they were like, they were going around doing raids. I had never seen that. I'd never heard of that in my city. That's not right. The government shouldn't be going around conducting raids. There's no need to be violent. There's no need to be racist, said one, and that they were there to show support. And I think that you see people responding to, look, I don't necessarily need to know your entire story. I don't need to know why you're here. But what I do need is to be holding accountable my government's actions. And you saw that with these Mexican women who were showing up with their minivans and serving up, you know, dozens upon dozens of dishes, and friendships were being made. And there was one woman who also had traveled from Brazil, and she returned the kindness, if you will, by braiding the hair of one of the Mexican women who had donated food.
That's beautiful. And lastly, you know, I just wanted to touch on this because you did highlight this in your piece. I wasn't really aware of the extent to which the Mexican government kind of mirrors some of the, I guess, militants in the United States. Of course, it's the U.S. is largely to blame, but I on the other side of things, I wasn't fully aware of their own efforts in this area.
This really began with under the Trump administration, and you saw the Mexico recruited to create a sort of another wall, which is along Mexico's southern border, where there's been a great deal of brutality in trying to intervene. And this goes back to what we discussed earlier in terms of a faulty deterrence policy. And then you have, in the case of Del Rio and Acuña, you have, with that bridge closed, there are dozens of factories that make products that are shipped into the United States for U.S. consumers, and that could not happen. And so you have the business community who all rallied and started putting pressure, saying we need that bridge to reopen. People are going to start losing their jobs. And so you had this massive, it was really applying pressure to the Mexicans to mobilize and assert its force through the closing of the bridge and the economic pressures. So there's so many multiple ways, but I think also one last thought here, which is before I traveled to Acuña, I had interviewed the sheriff of the neighboring county, Terrell County, which is Del Rio Acuña is the closest port of entry. Terrell County is some rough territory, rough country in terms of the landscape. It's really treacherous landscape to cross. And they had seen the number of people die that they had to recover, shoot up into over a dozen, which was really unheard of there because it is such a treacherous territory. And we have to remember that there are people who are dying and who are making decisions because of what's happening. And some of them are choosing to try to cross in other places they don't know the territory and are losing their lives. And this is serious.
Those are the stakes. Yeah.
That's right.
That should not be obscured. Michelle Garcia, she's a journalist based on the U.S.-Mexico border, and you can read her piece in The Intercept, Security Theater, U.S. Border Authorities Failed to Prepare for Influx of Haitian Migrants Despite Weeks of Warnings. Thank you so much for your time, Michelle. I really appreciate it.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
That's it for this week's Ring of Fire podcast. Hey, if you're listening to the free show right now, you're missing all the bonus content our members enjoy on a weekly basis. Go to rofpodcast.com now and become a member. It's your support that keeps us moving forward. On behalf of Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. Have a great weekend.